This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse or call us at 860-275-7266. Colin McEnroe is away this week, but the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, are here. I want to welcome in our guest panelists, Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. She's sitting in Colin's seat, and it's great to see you, Kalila. Thanks for being here.
Good to be back.
Also with us is Max Rees, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello there, Max.
Hey, good morning, John.
And Neil Vigdor is here. He's political reporter at the Hartford Courant. Hello there, Viggy.
Hey, John. Good morning.
Well, we always get to talk about the news of the week, and you know it's been a week since the very important Connecticut primaries. We'll be talking about that in just a little bit and some of the fallout attempts to bridge the gap with some party unity. But there was a little bit of news yesterday. Within just a few minutes in the afternoon in Alexandria, Virginia and New York City, news came out of federal courts. President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to allegations that he worked with a then-presidential candidate to keep two women from going public before the 2016 election with claims about their alleged affairs with Trump. Then came the jury's guilty verdict in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman and New Britain native Paul Manafort. We'll be talking about Manafort in a second. But first, here's Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal just moments ago on Morning Edition on NPR talking about Cohen and Trump.
We are in a Watergate moment when the president of the United States is an unnamed, unindicted co-conspirator. And the kind of wrongdoing he's committed cannot be pardoned. It would be an abuse of power and a possible obstruction of justice. And this investigation must be protected against the continuing assault and the attempt to intimidate and throw it off track.
So that's Richard Blumenthal talking this morning on Morning Edition. Kalila, elsewhere in the program, Lanny Davis, the lawyer for Michael Cohen, was very strong in his words, talking about the criminal activity of Donald Trump as he sees it, and also saying that the potential pardon that Richard Blumenthal alluded to there is something that Michael Cohen just won't take. So let's start with Michael Cohen. How big is this?
I think it's big for Michael Cohen. How big it will be for Trump, I think some people are inflating how big this will be. And I say that because for his supporters, I don't think this really matters to them. If you can have audio of a president bragging about touching a woman without her consent, you can have Omarosa leak these tapes of him lying about what he knew what was going on. Trump was right when he said 3 years ago, I can do whatever I want to do and not be held accountable. So for the voters and the supporters, it isn't a big deal. Who I think it matters the most is what are people in Congress going to do? How are you going to stand up to this, especially on the campaign trail when your constituents say, are you more loyal to your constituents or to this president?
Well, and let's, as we go through the Paul Manafort trial as well, and we talk about all the things that are now beginning to heat up as part of the Mueller investigation, there is the question of what might happen if indeed the Democrats take control of the House in the fall. It's the first time we've really actually started to hear people using the I word, impeachment, as something that might be forthcoming. Do you see that in the current political situation, Kalila, as something that's likely even with a Democratic majority?
I think that the Democrats have been playing scared for a very long time. So I don't think that if they regain the House that automatically we're going to see this impeachment process start. I think that what will happen is what's happening in some of the states about how people are lining up and whether they would support it. But what I think is also important, even if Trump is impeached, it does not mean that he will be removed from office. And when you continue to see high approval ratings across the board, we could definitely be in a situation where the president can be impeached and still be able to serve out his term.
This is remarkable times, Max, because it used to be if you had a political problem this bad, it would be just the death knell for the political life of a candidate. But as Kalila, I think, quite rightly says, to this president, it probably just doesn't matter that much.
I think Kalila's point's very well taken, that to the ardent supporters, the 30-40%, if you will, what happened yesterday between his campaign chairman and his attorney likely has little to no bearing at all. And a reporter for the Wall Street Journal was at the West Virginia rally that the president had last night and even said the crowd was still chanting lock her up. They were chanting drain the swamp on the same day that the lawyer and the chairman were both either pled guilty or were convicted. That just doesn't matter to a lot of people. And I think to the impeachment question, in a lot of those swingy districts, those plus one, plus two Republican point districts, the Democrats have been very scared to even utter the phrase impeachment because they feel like that would be a non-credible thing to say, that that would kind of take out their legs from under them in the middle of it. But you also know that in some of those districts where they're going to have people out knocking doors to try to flip those seats, that's exactly what a lot of those energized supporters are going to be saying.
I think the Michael Cohen's guilty plea is a much bigger problem for Trump than Paul Manafort being convicted on the eight counts of bank fraud and tax fraud. I mean, the charges that Cohen pled guilty to are felonies, and you know, his lawyer Lanny Davis has said that you know, the president directed Cohen to make these payoffs to Stormy Daniels and others. And I think that there was a great article, I believe it was in the New Republic yesterday, about how is this year kind of redux of 1974 Watergate. We heard Senator Blumenthal talking about Watergate yesterday. And in 74, the kind of Watergate babies, there was a blue surge in the House. And really, this year for Democrats, you know, it could be a chance for them to pick up maybe 40, 50 seats. And it's very possible that they could begin the articles of impeachment, you know, against Trump as an unindicted co-conspirator with Cohen to make these payments, you know, so that there would not be a negative reflection on him in the presidential race.
But as a political scientist, Kalila, I mean, you're charged with looking back at the conditions that were on the ground, as they say, during the Watergate era. And it's just a very, very different time, not just in terms of how the House and the Senate, the Congress of the United States conducts itself, how the Supreme Court is constituted, but also just how the American public views politics. There's an awful lot different between 2018 and 1974.
It's a very different landscape. I think the level of public trust in government is different, so that you had a trust in Congress separate from the presidency, separate from the Supreme Court. All of that has shifted. Even looking at the media landscape and the ability of the public to say, we trust journalists to tell us what's happening and to inform us so we can make this decision, now that is all shifted. So that when you have a president saying media is the enemy, as opposed to being a guardian for public trust and information, that will change the landscape and also change how much people know about the actual process of impeachment.
On what moves forward here, I think that it's a good question for both political scientists, but also for those who are running many of these campaigns. If you're a Democrat and the Democrats end up taking the House, which, by the way, mathematically, that looks like that's exactly what's going to happen when we all wake up on November 9th. But I think the fundamental question will be, will the Democrats be running the House in a resistant sort of fashion, or will they be attempting to run it in a governing sort of fashion? Will they try to work with what will likely still be a Republican Senate to get things done, or will they just be, frankly, an obstructionist Democratic Party on the House side, saying no? The only thing, because if they even pursue impeachment, what I'm saying is that will be the only thing that probably comes out of the next Congress. That would be the biggest major thing, because it's kind of hard to work with the other party when that party is trying to impeach your president.
To be fair, it's not as though the last few Congresses have gotten an awful lot done.
I think it depends on your perspective. I think that if you're a supporter of Trump or Republicans, the tax cut was a very big deal.
That was the big thing.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
However, it's also been a lot of, frankly, mumbo jumbo that's come out of Congress, if I may say.
Well,
so.
I also want to play a piece of tape. Here's Donald Trump reacting to the news about Paul Manafort while he was heading to a campaign style rally last night in West Virginia. I will just warn you, the audio quality here isn't great. But here's President Trump, courtesy of CNN, talking about Paul Manafort.
I must tell you that Paul Manafort's a good man. He was with Ronald Reagan. He was with a lot of different people over the years, and I feel very sad about that. It doesn't involve me, but I still feel, you know, it's a very sad thing that happened. This has nothing to do with Russian collusion. This started as Russian collusion. This has absolutely nothing to do. This is a witch hunt, and it's a disgrace. charges has nothing to do with what they started out looking for Russians involved in our campaign. There were none. I feel very badly for Paul Manafort. Again, he worked for Bob Dole. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He worked for many, many people. And that's the way it ends.
He did work for many, many people, including some people in Russia and the Ukraine that weren't named there. But, Neil, as you said earlier, perhaps on just the legal facts alone, what happened with Michael Cohen yesterday might be a bigger deal to the president than what happened with Paul Manafort. But let's just back up a little bit and talk about Paul Manafort. I know you've written a bit about this as well. Paul Manafort and the Manafort family, a huge name here in Connecticut. Here's a guy who has gone around the world representing all sorts of dictators and dictatorships and political people across America, fell into incredible financial hardship, probably of his own making, and then ends up now guilty on a whole bunch of charges.
Well, I was struck, having gone to Cleveland to cover the Republican National Convention in 2016, Connecticut, the delegation had one of the best spots on the floor, closest to the stage. And a lot of people at the time thought that that was due to the Manafort connection, New Britain guy. And I distinctly remember at the first delegation breakfast in Cleveland, Manafort was the speaker. He got a standing ovation from the Connecticut Republican. You had a bunch of GOP stalwarts posing for selfies, yucking it up with Manafort. And he was kind of seen as this strong hero figure who helped Trump clinch the nomination and was really brought in by Trump in anticipation of a contested convention. And now you look at it and it's like nobody wants to claim ownership of this guy. Oh, he doesn't really spend that much time in Connecticut. And I was struck a couple of weeks ago in interviewing Aaron Stewart, the New Britain mayor, and asking her whether or not the city would be changing Paul Manafort Drive, named for Manafort's father, who was the mayor for three terms in New Britain. And she said, no, it's named for the father. He did his service to the city. And then quietly last week, they changed it to Paul Manafort Senior Drive. So clearly people are, wanting to distance themselves from Manafort himself.
It's interesting. They're the president, as he's talking about how Paul Manafort, he feels very sorry for him. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He worked for an awful lot of people. There is still this opening for Paul Manafort with these convictions to cooperate and potentially get a lenient sentence. Remember that even though none of what he was convicted of has specific links to the so-called Russia investigation, these were charges that came out of the Mueller investigation. And I would assume, Kalila, Robert Mueller can sit down with Paul Manafort and say, okay, what you got? You probably don't want to spend the rest of your life in prison. I think we just heard the president there trying to play nice with someone who very well could say some stuff.
I think Trump believes that everyone is a good man except for good men. And thinking about what Manafort is really concerned about, this is a guy who went into the courtroom who preferred to be sockless as opposed to wear the white prison-issued socks because it didn't go with his suit. So clearly, this is going to be a major life change for him, where cooperation and showing his loyalty to himself is more important than being loyal to Trump. I think Trump is fearful. It's the same reason that he will not call out the president of Russia in a negative way, because he knows he has something that could be used against him.
Hmm. This is, I'm almost speechless that this is where we're at with what's going on in this country now. Like, we're talking about the wardrobe of the former campaign chairman of the president of the United States.
And who paid for it.
And I think that I don't know what the actual political consequence of this is going to be. You can't really predict it because I think if you're sitting here right now, every Democratic presidential candidate in a year and a half is going to start using all this stuff. But you can't help but wonder, is any of it really going to matter? Because some people might just say, well, he's still my president. That wasn't him. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen between now and then.
Yeah.
But how do all these things factor in? And It's, like I said, I'm almost speechless trying to come up with what the rationale or what it all looks like in the end.
We're going to turn to party unity on both the Republican and the Democratic side in just a moment out of the gubernatorial race that we just ended, the primary race. I will, though, ask Neil about what this means for Connecticut Republicans. Bob Stefanowski, you know, when you're running a primary campaign, you're trying to appeal to a certain type of base that you will not want to appeal to in the general election. He had ads that actually had Donald Trump in them, not speaking for him, but pictures of Donald Trump. He spoke about the president, if not in glowing terms, certainly positively, gave him an A rating, etc. Now, whether it's Stefanowski or the party itself, J.R. Romano, what are they going to do with this increasingly toxic Trump aspect in a state like Connecticut, where the typical Republican ain't really like a typical Republican in a lot of other parts of the country?
The fascinating thing here is that the big knock on Stefanowski during the primary campaign from his other Republican opponents was that he was registered as a Democrat during the 2016 presidential election. Now, he didn't vote, but you would think that that would kind of take the Trump factor out of this and that that would take that off the table. But then Stefanowski has gone and last week he welcomed the endorsement of Donald Trump over Twitter. And then you had Ned Lamont calling him Bob Trumpanowski, and then Stefanowski shot back at him and called him Ned Malloy. And so it seems to me like Stefanowski is going to have to really be asked what the deal was with him in 2016 and how come you were a Democrat and did you register as a Democrat because you had issues with Trump? But he's kind of undercutting himself by him. So it's a very kind of threading the needle here for Stefanowski on this.
I had a whole conversation with this yesterday with a colleague. I think it's so hard to just not embrace Trump. I think it's just very difficult to do it because if in Connecticut, Republicans really think this is their year. They think this is the year we can take the governor's residence. We can take the House and the Senate. They think these are all the things they can do. And a lot of those people still voted for Donald Trump. I would bet most, if not all of them, probably did. But a lot of them are still open, though, to not voting for a Democrat. Independent voters, I'm saying. They're open to not voting for a Democrat. But Bob Stefanowski embraced the endorsement. He used him in his ads. He's even said many, many times, we really need something like Donald Trump in Connecticut. That's the kind of management we need. Cut better deals with the unions, et cetera. All those things are very Trumpian comments that are kind of hard to square.
So I think the key difference here is that we have such a large population of independent voters in Connecticut. So the Republican Party will have to thread this needle very carefully. But at the same time, one of the key strengths for Republicans is that they collapse inward and they support their party. And they're able to manage those internal conflicts in a way that Democrats cannot. 2 years later, and Democrats are still trying to figure out, are you pro-Bernie or not? And that becomes the marker for whether there's enough energy and excitement in the base. So to also think about the ads kind of write themselves here, that you don't get to stand in front of the Gold Dome and talk about corruption and collusion and not address that at the national level with the chief executive really for your party.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk more about party unity. We'll try to discuss a little bit more what's happening in the governor's race right now. I like what you said, Neil. He was registered as a Democrat for many years, but never voted. It sort of reminds me of Bill Clinton. Remember, I tried marijuana, but I didn't inhale. It sort of reminded
what's
me
the
that.
Point?
Yeah, what's the point? We'll talk a little bit more about some of the contradictions in this very weird week of news with Max Reese, Neil Vigdor, and Kalila Brown Dean here on the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news, and there's a lot of it, at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can always join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can also find us on CTN, the Connecticut Network, today as well. We're joined by Neil Vigdor. He's political reporter at the Hartford Current. Max Reese, who's political reporter for NBC Connecticut. And sitting in for Colin McEnroe today is Kalila Brown Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. We haven't seen as much of you recently, Kalila, because you've been in a big project. You're writing a book?
Yes.
What's the book on?
So it's called Identity Politics, Context, and Controversy. And it really grows out of discussions I've had with my students who want to understand what's going on in our country right now. And I keep saying to them, the past is prologue. Nothing is new. The debates we see about immigration now are the same debates when we were deciding whether people from Ireland should be able to come. And this fear we had that Catholics were going to take over the public school system. So it's a way for not just students, but the average interested person to see how it all comes together. And more importantly, what we can do to move the country forward.
When's the book coming out?
Fall 2019.
Fall 2019. So still a lot of work ahead, but we're going to be looking forward to that.
Very excited.
Very cool. So Kalilah Brown Dean from Quinnipiac University with us. We started to talk a little bit about the race for governor. It's down to three men, including Oz Griebel. Well, maybe more than three men. We can talk about that. Oz Griebel's not officially qualified to be on the ballot yet as an independent candidate. Looks like he probably will, though. After these bitter campaigns in the primary, Ned Lamont and Bob Stefanowski have the task of uniting their parties, enlisting the help of those whose ambitions to be governor came to a screeching halt last Tuesday. Here is Lamont at a rally in Hartford on Saturday, giving a bit of a shout-out to his friend Joe Ganim, who was in the crowd.
We are going to be fighting for Connecticut values. You know what that means? That means opportunity for all.
Yes.
My friend Joe Ganim reminded me every day, an economy that works for everybody. An economy that works for everybody. It means we celebrate our diversity.
Okay, so that's Ned Lamont giving a shout-out, Max, to his friend Joe Ganim. I didn't think that they were so chummy-chummy during the primary.
They're buddies. I don't know if they've ever played golf together at the Round Hill Club, but they're just buddies now. Ned Lamont did a very good job in the race, and I think also the thing he had going for him, which we all learned, was the negativity and the animosity toward Joe Ganim around the state, which what I said on television, I'll say here, in a race without polling, it was always hard to quantify it, but then we kind of got these remarkable numbers, 82.5% to like 17.5%. But Lamont did a very good job of we use the phrase threading the needle mm-hmm. earlier, of not criticizing Joe Ganim, but also trying to run his own race with a credible primary opponent. Well, now he has to shift to the general election now. And the way I see this race right now on August 22nd is you got one guy who's against any and all taxes, and Ned Lamont, in a roundabout kind of way, is almost like defending the way things have kind of always been in a roundabout kind of way, while also saying, well, I stand for a lot of other things than just the economy, trying to get Stefanowski on the stump on things like gay marriage, on abortion, and things like that. And I don't know which one of those is going to prevail in the end, but I would say so far, Lamont has done a pretty good job of avoiding some of the landmines, if you will.
Yeah, what do you see out of these two so far in this last week, Neil? Because we weren't exactly sure how much either of these men were going to come out of the gates after the primary. Very famously, when Ned Lamont won his first primary over Joe Lieberman in a run for Senate, he kind of stumbled out of the gate and wasn't able to build momentum then to the general election in November. Do you see him coming out a bit stronger than Bob Stefanowski?
I know that there was a story the other day that Stefanowski's been kind of in witness protection since his primary victory. I know that Stefanowski did make some public appearances over the weekend. I thought it was interesting that his campaign did not send out media advisories ahead of time, as campaigns tend to do about where their candidate is going to be. I know that yesterday that Stefanowski hosted J.R. Romano and the rest of the Republican under ticket for statewide office at his campaign headquarters in Branford. I think that there's significance to the fact that this took place at Stefanowski's campaign headquarters and not at the CTGOP headquarters in Southington. And it's almost like, okay, well, you come to us. We won the primary. And I wrote a story that appeared over the weekend where I talked about this kind of anecdote at the Connecticut Republican Convention that Stefanowski bypassed, and his campaign manager tried to go onto the convention floor and use somebody else's credential, and one of the Connecticut GOP officials came over, ripped it off his neck, and tore it up to shreds. And I thought it was striking to see that same social media digital director for the CTGOP kind of making peace and making nice with Stefanowski's team on Twitter and retweeting him. And there's this kind of kumbaya moment now. Stefanowski, I think.
Do Republicans really sing kumbaya? I mean, we say that, but do they actually get around the campfire and strum and sing kumbaya?
Well, I definitely think that there are still some bruised egos in the GOP, and that Stepanowski has some work to do here to bring other people into the fold. And, I think that it'll be interesting to see how much Mark Boughton plays along and helps him out for the general election.
I want to ask about that, Clive, this idea of party unity. On the Democratic side, there are maybe a couple of factions, you know, as you said. Who was the Bernie supporter? Who is the Hillary supporter? The new guard and the old guard, even if Bernie Sanders is a fairly old new guard. I'm wondering what you see on the Republican side, where in many ways the number of candidates who were running for governor and still on the primary ballot sort of show up all the different types and flavors of Republicans that you might have here today. People who've been in government but want to run things from a fiscally conservative way, people who have more socially conservative views, people who really just want to come in from the outside and say, like Donald Trump, I'm going to cut taxes and run this like a business. So how do you bring all these factions together?
Well, I think the way that you bring all of those factions together is by asking, do you want another Malloy administration? And that has been the very simplistic language that we've been hearing, so that this becomes a referendum on Malloy and on Trump, and not necessarily saying you need to vote for Stepanowski, you're voting against Democratic control. And I think it's interesting, the dynamics of this race will be very different from what we've seen before, because Democrats often argue, does this person look like the base? Can they represent that? Now you have two very wealthy candidates from both parties, and in a state and in a country where we tend to see poverty as a moral indictment and wealth as sort of a privileged benefit for being a good person or making these smart money decisions, that goes off the table. And I think what we also need to look at is how the candidates will play the cities versus the suburbs here when we talk about economic benefit and development for the state.
I'm wondering, Max, because I wanted to get back to the other big outcome of this, as Neil said, everyone getting together on the Republican side at the Stepanowski headquarters, not the CTGOP. What Stepanowski did, seen as a rebuke to the entire party apparatus, bypassing the convention altogether. What does that say about the Connecticut Republican Party?
Well, I think that one of the points that Neil made on their turf, at the end of the day, the best campaign run by anybody over the last 9 months is Bob Stepanowski, and it's not even close. So if we're going to be real about this, the party can probably learn a lot from what Stepanowski did. And oh, by the way, get rid of this convention system, folks, both sides. Just get rid of it. It's a waste of time. It's not good for really anybody.
Hear, hear.
But I'll also say this. Jay Romano did a ton of work to try to make the Connecticut Republican gubernatorial race the most relevant one in people's minds in the news cycle. He had this series of debates, like 6-7 of them, that started in December or November of last year, made it all the way through May. Who's the only person who really wasn't there the entire time? Bob Stepanowski. Mm-hmm. So it is an indictment of everything they did. However, all that being said, we were still talking about the Republican race more than any other. The other thing I'll say to one of Neil's points about how quiet the Stepanowski campaign has been, Tom Foley 4 years ago, we had no earthly idea what that guy was doing on a daily basis during the last, I would say, 6 weeks of the campaign, where you'd get a press release at 10 a.m. and they would say, hey, we're going to be in Vernon at 11. And, you know, we are wherever we are at that point. You got to get there. And Stepanowski has been very quiet. I think he had a personal engagement of some kind last week. But whereas Ned Lamont, I think, has sent about an email an hour at this point to our inboxes. So I would say that's the opposite of slow out the gate for Lamont.
I would also point out that the Democrats are kind of throwing the kitchen sink at Stepanowski. If you look at every day, your inbox gets filled up with emails from the state party where they have surrogates. The other day they had a group of women who are running for office. Some of them are incumbents. Some of them are first-time candidates. Kind of asking where is Stepanowski on reproductive rights and that he's been silent, and trying to draw attention to the fact that his running mate, Joe Markley, is one of the most right-wing people under the Golden Dome. And I would expect that the Democrats will do this day in and day out through November, that they're going to be doing these conference calls. And it's like, is Stepanowski going to be playing defense here the whole time?
And one other point. Kalilu made a great point about that urban-rural divide, or the, how you connect those economically. The best weapon the Democrats might have here is Jahana Hayes. They might just want to hold a bunch of rallies, a bunch of press conferences in the 5th congressional district.
And with her outside that district.
Right, right. And just get her out there with Ned Lamont, with William Tong, with Susan Bisewitz to show, no, we're not same old, same old. And even though, of course, she's the 5th CD and she's still the favorite there. But
and even though the Democratic establishment didn't necessarily come down in her favor during that convention system that we talked about earlier.
That could be their ticket to picking up votes in places where they're really going to need them.
Do you make something of that, Kalilu?
Well, I think beyond that, this will be a race that is one based on mobilization and getting people to the polls. So in those cities where Bermuda Zimmerman did very well in New Haven, and she was able to tap into demographics that usually don't go into primaries, but it felt really left out and disaffected by the entire political process. That is a way to push back against that idea that Bisewitz and Lamont don't look like the base, don't look like the communities that are really struggling right now. But it's also a part of tying into that national narrative. Getting that national focus is going to be key for bringing resources into the state. And of also, as you said, blowing up those traditional politics as usual. The political game is not how it was 2 years ago and certainly not 10 years ago.
And talking about resources, I want to turn to something you've been writing about, Neil, whether or not the Citizens Election Program actually is something that can work on behalf of Republicans, really, in the state. We had all these candidates. A few of them were able to avail themselves of money from the Citizens Election Program. We've had quite some debate here on the program about whether or not the taxpayers of Connecticut should pay for a Citizens Election Program to fund people in a primary that about 900,000 voters don't get a chance to vote in. We'll set that aside for right now and just talk about whether or not Tim Herbst or others are disadvantaged by a Citizens Election Program that really allows them to be outspent by people with a lot of money like Bob Stefanowski.
Well, if you're a budget hawk, you're happy that you have two, and I'll say mostly self-funders as the nominees, because Lamont and Stefanowski are going to save the state something like $15 million. If you're a fan of the public financing system and this whole mantra of quote-unquote leveling the playing field, that this is seen as a disappointment or negative development. The other Republicans, I talked to Tim Herbst the other day, and he didn't get his money, $1.35 million for the primary until June 20th. And Boughton the same day. And he said at that point the cake was baked, and that Stefanowski, who spent $2.3 million of his own money and then had $600,000 in contributions, was able to saturate the airwaves for 7 to 8 weeks. He had a monopoly on TV. And by the time these other candidates had their grants approved, and Steve Obsitnik, of course, is the kind of poster child for this, he didn't get his money until July 18th, that the race was over by that point. And going back, I think that those TV ads that Stefanowski ran, I think that they can have kind of a, they were speaking to Republican primary voters, but, unaffiliated people watch Fox News too, and they see the message. So I wonder how much of a kind of residual value those TV commercials have.
Like we said earlier, I mean, Bob Stefanowski kind of rewrote the playbook here for how you can run and win a primary. And the ultimate irony of all this, the wealthiest person, I believe, on either side, and when you look at their filings differently, David Stemmerman,
by one shot.
Yeah, and David Stemmerman, in an ultimate irony, ended up running, you could probably even argue, probably was the worst campaign because he had the most money, but he didn't get on the air until March or April, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Maybe even been May, and Bob Stefanowski already owned the airwaves before then. He was able to define himself before anybody could define him.
It's interesting, though, Kalilu, there's so many data points, even just in Connecticut, about money spent in political campaigns mm-hmm. over the course of the last decade or so. While it's very important for a Steve Obsitnik to get some money and so he can actually run a campaign, he doesn't until a month beforehand, and it goes right down mm-hmm. the tubes. We also have all of these candidates, Tom Foley a couple times, Linda McMahon a couple times, Ned Lamont a couple times before this, being self-funders and not really being able to get any traction. As Max has said with David Simmerman, you can have a lot of money, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to run a good campaign. So how much should we worry about money, whether or not it's coming from somebody's personal pocketbook or whether or not it's coming from our pocketbook through the CEP?
I think we should worry about it a lot. The word that comes to mind is obscene. When you have in the New Haven Public Schools District laying off 28 full-time educators because we can't figure out this funding process and how to make sure kids have an opportunity to be educated, and then you could throw away money in a race, it says something about our priorities. But beyond that, it's also about the entry point, so that we keep getting the same candidates and the same politicians because it takes so much money or the ability to raise and mobilize money to even be viewed as a credible candidate. So until we address that part of it, then we will still be arguing about, well, does it matter if this person's net worth is $5 million versus $10 million versus realizing that the person who makes $50,000 a year may actually be more resourceful and know how to do more with less and actually right-size some things. So I think that's the bigger picture here. Money is still important in politics. Looking at the amount of dark money that is going to flow into this gubernatorial race, we've already seen some of the campaign ads. We are on a path that I don't see changing anytime soon.
And of course, Max, we should talk about the fact that we've got an independent candidate, Oz Griebel, who's not yet on the ballot but expects to get on the ballot, who has been running an underfinanced campaign, let's just put it that way, and hasn't gotten a whole lot of traction. We also haven't had any real public polling about any of this, which is maybe a question for another day. But what hope does an Oz Griebel have? He picks a Democrat as his running mate. He says, I'm going to go right down the middle on stuff. I'm going to be conservative on some issues. I'm going to be liberal on some issues. And does he even have a shot as we head toward November?
I think the short answer is he probably doesn't have a shot. But it's funny when you talk – when we spoke with Oz last week, a few of us did, and there's a mathematical way to do it. There's a mathematical way to make it to win. He's got to get about 33% to 35%. The problem is he has no money. That's problem number one, which Kalilah was talking about. They're doing it the old-fashioned way. They did not attempt to qualify for public financing as a petitioning independent running candidate. They're not independent party. They're just an independent petitioner. So they're going to be running, I believe, as Oz for CT. That's what you'll see them on the ballot if and when they qualify. But if they're not going to have the money and that kind of operation – even $500,000, that would pay for direct Facebook pushes. That would pay for Twitter pushes. They could pay for a billboard or two, in all seriousness. But that's going to be during the carpet bombing, if you will, of TV ads against Ned Lamont and Bob Stefanowski that we're all going to be sick of by the time November rolls around.
I think beyond even money, just name ID, you know, Oz is really kind of a Hartford guy. And, you know, obviously a lot of people remember his work on the Transportation Strategy Board. And he's seen as this kind of wonky guy and, you know, very policy oriented. But I think that there is a deficit in terms of name recognition, particularly in Fairfield County, downstate, that's going to be big issue for him.
In a lot of ways, it kind of feels like a John Kasich-like candidate in Connecticut currently, where if you were to probably poll what he says, what he believes on different kinds of topics, whether it's tolls or taxes or collective bargaining, all those, I would be willing to bet that a lot of that's kind of straight in line with a lot of people are thinking. But he's not fitting into the mold we've been talking about on the left or the right. So it's that's the problem.
One way I think he's not like John Kasich is probably in 2 years I won't still be getting daily emails from Oz Griebel explaining what the candidate would have done had he been elected president. I just want to say one last thing about this, Kalilah. And we were talking just before the primary and during the day of the primary. They were expecting very, very low turnout, that people weren't going to get very excited. We're reading from our friend Caitlin Krasselt and Hearst Connecticut Media here. More voters showed up to cast a ballot in last week's primary than have in any primary since 2006. A sign the momentum picked up by both parties after the 2016 election won't slow anytime soon. About 32% of registered Republicans and 29% of registered Democrats voted in the primary, according to the latest results. What does that tell you? That people actually turned out for this August primary, at least in numbers that are better than they have in the past?
I think two things. One, people understand that the stakes are incredibly high right now. I think it also again, goes back to money. It was hard to not know that a primary was happening, even if you didn't have a particular candidate that you really had a strong affinity for. But I expect between now and November, that will increase as we start to get more national attention. And again, that ground game will matter, more events, more I can only imagine what the debate between Stefanowski and Lamont will be like, and whether that will be what mobilizes people or if it will be these surrogates who really get the energy going.
I will say that I'm currently working with the CCIC, our friends at Fox 61 and the Connecticut Mirror, to try to get together a debate very soon on September 5th. And we're still awaiting confirmation from the candidates that they will take part in that debate. There will be a few debates forthcoming, and we're going to see how that goes. I think both candidates have some reasons to both debate and also to duck those debates. We're in the wheelhouse, and we're talking with Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, Neil Vigder, political reporter at the Hartford Current. When we come back, what does the Connecticut congressional delegation think about Nancy Pelosi? I mean, if indeed the House of Representatives turns Democratic, should she still be their leader come November? Let's find out more in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Colin McEnroe away this week, but we're happy to have Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut, and Neil Vigdor, political reporter at the Hartford Current. Before we get to our next topic at hand, I guess we should do dramatic readings of Donald Trump tweets. We were talking about Donald Trump earlier. We played a little piece of tape of him praising Paul Manafort, feeling very, very sorry for him. Well, here's a few tweets from just this morning in case you haven't been on Twitter yet. Number one, if anyone is looking for a good lawyer, I would strongly suggest that you don't retain the services of Michael Cohen!
There's also probably a lot of Michael Cohen attorneys, I'm just saying, out there.
There's a poor Michael Cohen attorney somewhere in Ohio is like, oh my God.
There's a bunch of them.
This is really a problem. The second tweet, I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. A justice, in quotes, took a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, applied tremendous pressure on him. And unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to, in quotes, break, make up stories in order to get a in quotes, deal. Such respect for a brave man, exclamation point. Then he writes, a large number of counts, 10 could not even be decided in the Paul Manafort case, witch hunt, and Michael Cohen pled guilty to 2 counts of campaign finance violations that are not a crime. President Obama, Kalila, had a big campaign finance violation and has easily settled. I think you won the bet. You won the poll,
here
as to how soon he would actually blame this on President Obama.
I figured it would either be a blame on Obama or blame Hillary Clinton. What I think is interesting, though, is if you listen to these tweets, basically what Donald Trump is saying is stop snitching. And this is exactly what we tell people who live in urban areas all the time, that you need to cooperate, you should be honest, and not protect people that you know are doing wrong. So we'll take a knee on that one.
Let me just follow up on that. It really is interesting, the idea that we should, as a society, unfailingly and unflaggingly listen to the authorities when they tell certain people to do certain things. It is just without question that the authority is in the right. And you, no matter who you are, probably if your skin looks different than mine, you should do exactly what they say. But for others, people who've done white-collar crimes, people who don't want to wear socks to court because it clashes with their suit, those people, the cops are out to get them.
Well, and it goes, if we think about what's happening in our country right now, all of these cases regarding law enforcement misconduct, the ways that the president has questioned the intelligence community and really undermined this bastion of freedom for so long, why is it that we should trust him to make this decision? And it also goes to this idea that there are not just one set of laws and one set of rules. It varies based on the person that we think is offending them, but it also varies based on what we think we can get out of the return. So when you have someone that violates the public trust and violates public money to do it, that to me is much more offensive and egregious.
I want to turn to another kind of question of party unity. After 15 years as the Democratic leader in the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi no doubt has become a polarizing figure. During a recent interview with CNN's Poppy Harlow, Connecticut Representative Jim Himes praised Pelosi but refused to say if he would support her return to the House Speaker post should Democrats regain control. Here's that clip.
Is Democratic leadership in the House too old and too white?
Well, Poppy, look, having said that I am a huge admirer of Nancy Pelosi's operational ability. The fact that our top three leaders are in their late 70s, I don't care who those leaders are, that is in fact a problem. It is a problem because, of course, you know, we are at a moment in time where young people are involved as they never have been before. These are the Parkland students getting young people involved. And I don't care how good you are, there is a generational gap. And so, again, you can ask me for a yes, no answer for what happens 4 months from now. But very clearly, you know, soon the Democratic Party is going to need to get some faces and some people who can speak to people in their 40s, to people in their 20s.
I didn't see the whole clip, Max. I'm not sure if she asked the yes-no question and what his answer was, but please, your response.
So I think that there is a clear divide among some Democrats in the establishment in Connecticut and others. Jim Himes, you'd probably put on the Chris Murphy, Johanna Hayes side of things, but then you'd put probably John Larson, Joe Courtney, and Rosa DeLauro on the other side of things. And, you know, I think that this is a big question for them. We pressed Johanna Hayes during the debate that we hosted at NBC Connecticut a couple weeks ago between Mary Glassman and her. And she said, I'm open to seeing everybody who would apply, who'd want to be Speaker of the House, but said, but if given the option right now, I would not vote for Nancy Pelosi. Then there's Joe Courtney and John Larson and Rosa DeLauro, who I would be willing to bet have a pretty darn good relationship with Nancy Pelosi and might be in line for committee chairmanships, et cetera. So I think that that's a fundamental question that we're going to be seeing over the next few weeks.
Let's not forget that Jim Himes is the head of the New Democrat Coalition, which is the kind of centrist group of House Democrats. And his being noncommittal here, I think, is pretty telling. As I think Max brings up a good point that, you know, DeLauro and Pelosi, you know, have a very strong rapport. And, you know, I don't see Rosa DeLauro, you know, ever coming out against Nancy Pelosi.
But I also think it's about what we expect the Speaker or the Chair to do. What is it that we want the Speaker of the House to do? It has to be someone that can hold the party together, that can navigate those norms. And that doesn't really happen for someone that's brand new, especially if Democrats retake the House. You need someone who can hit the ground running to really get things done. If not, you'll end up with another Tea Party resurgence where you can ride the wave for 2 years. And while you're doing that, people are organizing to completely regain control.
I'm wondering, in the question of Nancy Pelosi, the question that was asked there that we heard Jim Himes responding to, is leadership too old and too white? There is another way to kind of look at this. Nancy Pelosi has been around for a long time. A lot of Democrats really, really like her. It's very clear that because of her track record, she is a very polarizing figure. It's very easy to put her in campaign commercials on the Republican side and say, see, look, this is who we're running against, Nancy Pelosi. But there is at least a whiff, Kalilah, of what happened with Hillary Clinton as well. You have one of the most powerful women in political history poised to become the first female president. And there's an awful lot of people saying, well, she's too old, she's too white, she has too much political baggage. And there is this issue that is the undercurrent, which is she's also a very powerful woman. And I'm not necessarily sure if the old white man who might be in charge of the House Democrats might be getting the same treatment. Is that a wrong thing to think?
No, I think gender matters here. I think that gender is a way that we can sort of vilify people for being powerful and for ascending to these positions and not necessarily playing the same old boys network that plays out for other people. What I don't want us to lose sight of, however, is that Speaker of the House is one position, and in some ways it's a symbolic position. If you look at the crop of candidates for Congress right now, they are more diverse than ever before. The fact that we could have our first two Native American, American Indian women entering the United States Congress, and the fact that it takes 2018 to make those kind of markers, it's not about saying that just because you look a certain way, we should trust you. It's about if Congress really wants to represent the American people, it needs to look like the American people in terms of economics, in terms of education, and a whole host of factors.
Kalilah Brown-Dean is Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and she's got one of the great Twitter handles. It's at KBDPhD. Kalilah, thanks as always. Good
thanks,
to see you.
Thanks, John.
Neil Vigdor is here. He's political reporter at the Hartford Courant. His Twitter handle is Gettin' Viggy, which is my other favorite Twitter handle. Thank you so much, Neil.
Thanks, John. Fun to be here.
And Max Reese from NBC Connecticut is at Max Reese.
I'm so boring. I got to change it to the dude with the twins or something.
Thanks to Kyone Wolf and Scott Breed and everyone who helps to produce The Wheelhouse here on Connecticut Public Radio.